I studied all kinds of therapy, but the main one in my school at Columbia University, Clinical Psychology Department, was non-directive therapy of Carl Rogers, because they were enthusiastic about that form of therapy. So I studied all the others, but that was their thing.
But then you foolishly decide that Freud is a better bet.
Yes, that was after I got my PhD in clinical psychology in 1947, and I thought that analysis, both Freudian and liberal analysis of Karen Horney and Eric Frome and Harry Sachs Sullivan, was the best bet. So I got myself analyzed, which you had to be in order to practice analysis, and then I got control. We psychologists were not allowed to be analysts according to the American Psychoanalytic Association, but I found an analyst who was liberal in that respect and who supervised my analytic work.
And Albert Ellis, was this a revelation to you? Did you discover a lot about Albert Ellis that you hadn't previously known?
No, because I was able to free associate very liberally when I, my very first session, when he said, do free association, say anything that comes into your mind. So that's the way I think and speak. And I went on for a full hour steadily from one thing to another. And he said at the end of that hour, my, you certainly can talk, can't you? Because he was used to other people clamming up with free association.
But you, in a sense, begin to suspect the process in that it seems to you inefficient.
Yes, as I did psychoanalysis, and I helped some people, because merely by listening to them and accepting them as humans, you can help them. But I found out that they didn't change very much, and they especially didn't change their behavior. They thought somewhat differently and agreed to more sensible ways of living, but they actually were scared witless in carrying them out. So they didn't change their behavior, and I saw that psychoanalysis, practically all forms, doesn't have homework assignments as some of the other behavioral therapies do.
Before we leave Freud, what was your assessment of him? I know that you don't dispute for a second his genius.
Well, I think he was a genius and really marvelously saw how people were disturbed and did not know what to do about it. So he understood a lot of them, and he invented or created some of the main things in psychotherapy, such as defensiveness, that people are defensive and rationalize. But again, he didn't know how to undo it. And most of his cases were really very fictionalized. He almost got the Nobel Prize for fiction one time. He was suggested for him, and I think he should have got it, because he dramatically, nicely wrote up the cases, but as other people investigated years later, the facts that he gave were not true to the facts of the patients.
I'd like you to talk to us about that principal idea you developed of the centrality of the irrational belief. Talk to us about irrational beliefs.
Well, my hobby was philosophy from the age of 16 onward. I loved it and read it, all of ancient and modern philosophers. And they were constructivists, most of them, not all. They believed that you didn't get disturbed, you made yourself disturbed. By, as Epictetus said 2,000 years ago, it's never the things that happen to you that upset you, it's your view of them. And I realized that he was right, and that all those philosophers, at least most of them, talked to people, got their view of things that they were upsetting themselves with, and then sometimes were able to change them. So I did it more specifically than the other philosophers did and realized that when you feel upset, you don't just get upset by your mother and father and sister and brother and presidents of the United States or kings of England. You make yourself upset by taking things seriously, which is fine, but then you take them too seriously, and you awfulize about them.
Awfulize. That's a great word.
Yes, that means you take a thing which may be important, but sometimes a minor important, and if it happened, it might be bad for you, and you see it as being disastrous, awful, the end of the world, and things like that.
Well, how do you unawfulize? What's the process of unawfulizing?
Unawfulizing means you take things seriously, consider them, and then see what you can do about them. And if you can't do anything about the bad things that happen, you accept what you can't change. You don't like it, but you accept it. But when you awfulize, you say, it's terrible, horrible, awfulize, and I can't do anything about it. And you sit on your rump and do very little.
Okay, I present myself to you, and I'm awfulizing something or other. Are you sympathetic, compassionate, or stern with me?
Well, I'm first very open to whatever you say and sympathetic and empathic and listen, and I take seriously what you say. Even if I say to myself, I think he's making up some of these details, but I listen to you as if they really existed. So that's very empathic and good listening. But then, as you tell me that you got very, very upset by some relatively minor thing, I start saying to you, I question not your rational ideas. This is bad because you didn't like it and it is bad, but you awfulize and say, this is horrible. I can't stand it. I can't be happy at all. So those are irrational beliefs, and I start questioning how you exaggeratedly and absolutely dogmatically believe them, and I try to get you to be more open to yourself and your own belief system and to see that a belief is okay, but you better have some facts to back it up. And when you awfulize, you don't seem to really have any facts. You just make up that it's horrible and awful instead of a royal pain, which it is.
But Albert Ellis, you and I, as atheists, as humanists, live in a world surrounded, dominated, overwhelmed by irrational belief. I mean, people seem to be sustained by it in their religious beliefs and their cultural affiliations.
Sometimes they have a good irrational belief. For example, that there is a kindly and loving God and that he will take care of me when I can't take care of myself. So that may help them, even though there may not be such a God. They're just inventing it. But the thought that there is help from such a supernatural being may help. But on the other hand, they very frequently invent an avenging God who's going to really zap them and cut their testicles off if they do the wrong thing. And that's very unhelpful. So it isn't the religious view itself, but it's the kind of view that it is and the dogma of it that is often irrational and leads to problems. But not all the time, because some people really do help themselves with ideas which are basically false, but which work for them.
Now, listeners, hold on to your testicles. We're listening to Dr. Albert Ellis, the eminent psychologist of the Albert Ellis Institute in New York and around the world. But, of course, rational emotive therapy, which used to be on the shingle, is your invention. Tell us what it means.
Well, it's now rational emotive behavior therapy because it has thinking elements and feeling elements and behavioral elements, because I said in my first paper on it at the American Psychological Association Chicago way back in 1956. When you think, you feel and behave. When you behave, you think and feel. And when you feel, you think and behave. Therefore, your what we call emotional disturbance, your problems, your neurotic way has thoughts and feelings and actions in it. And in rational emotive therapy, we listen to you carefully, parse out what those thoughts, feelings, and actions are, show you the good, sensible, practical, rational parts of it, but then also show you that aspects of your thought, your feeling, and your behavior is quite bad, meaning that it does you in and doesn't help you to get the goals that you would like to achieve.
Now, many of us would acknowledge that we have within us self-defeating tendencies. Would you argue that we're born with them, or are they culturally acquired or loaded onto us by our families?
Well, with Alfred Korzybski, the head of general semantics, I take the and also attitude. It's not the either or. We're first of all born with tendency to think very sensibly and rationally, or else we wouldn't survive. So we can't be born with all negative tendencies. But we also are born with the tendency to take our preferences, goals, and desires to be well and to be happy and to get along with ourselves and others and raise them into musts, shoulds, oughts, demands, dogmas. And when we do that irrationally, then we feel and behave very badly and against our own interests. We sabotage our main interests. So rational emotive behavior therapy shows you precisely what you think and how you feel and how you behave, how it is both helpful, meaning rational and self-helping, but also irrational and self-defeating. Parses them out, and then it shows you how to question and challenge and think about and act against your irrational masturbatory beliefs, because you not only happily masturbate, but unfortunately you unhappily masturbate. The tyranny of the shoulds, as Karen Horney said.
You're adding wonderfully to our vocabulary here tonight. We've got awfulizing, and now we've got masturbation. What are the three demands that you identify as leading to neurotic behavior?
Well, practically all human beings, practically, not all over the world, have three major musts which drive them to distraction and maybe destroy the entire world in war and Holocaust, etc. And the first is themselves. I, ego, must absolutely do well and be loved by significant other people, or I am a turd for acting turdily, as I must not. And then you get depressed, anxious, despairing. That's a real lulu. But if that weren't crazy enough, because how are you always going to do well and marvelous? Even I can't do that all the time, so you certainly can't. Then the second one says other people over whom I have no control whatsoever, because they could do any damn thing they want to do if they want to do it, they absolutely must treat me kindly, nobly, and considerately and think the way I do, or else I know what hell they should roast in for eternity. And then you get anger, fury, rage, wars, genocide, Holocaust, terrorism, etc. That's a lulu. And then finally,
that certainly is a lulu, yeah.
Yeah. And finally, conditions under which I live, the economy, the ecology, etc., must be nice and easy and give me what I want and never deprive me. Or it's awful, horrible, terrible. I can't stand it and I can't be happy at all, which causes depression and low frustration tolerance. Now, there are many hundreds of other musts, but they usually, practically always, fall under those three major headings.
And here we are, masturbation. Now, to what extent do you affect cures? To what extent are you able to see some troubled, disturbed, masturbating person come into your orbit and leave transformed?
Well, I don't like the word cure because people are born with tendencies to masturbate, and they're also raised, it's both and, not either or, with tendencies to do so, and they practice them all their lives and make them worse and worse and worse, and therefore, in rational emotive behavior therapy, we can fairly quickly and somewhat easily show them how they're upsetting themselves and how not to, but it takes them a while to get to it and practice it. They have to work and practice it out.
Well, Albert Ellis, these days the talking cures are confronted by the chemical cures. To what extent do you tolerate or practice medical interventions of that sort?
Well, we are liberal in that sort, and we don't think like some psychiatrists and psychologists, unfortunately, think that medication is all bad. We say that some people, especially the severe depressives and the people who are angry at everything and the people who are chronically anxious, their neurotransmitters and all other neurological aspects in their brain is off, and therefore they easily practice foolish acts to themselves and others' behavior. So we give them rational emotive behavior therapy and show them what they're doing and how not to do it. But in some cases, a minority of cases, we recommend that they experiment with antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs and other kinds of things to see how they work for them.
Albert, you're an atheist. Have you always been an atheist?
Well, I was a believer and fairly religious up to the age of 12 and outly followed some of those rules. But then I realized that in all probability, not certainty, there are no supernatural things, and that if I thought there were none and became an atheist rather than an agnostic, which a lot of people become, that there would very, very likely be no God or devil to punish me. So I preferred to start thinking for myself at the age of 12 and say that on probabilistic grounds, there's very little likelihood that there is anything supernatural.
What idea of death import in the pathology of people you deal with?
Well, not too many, because most of them hate themselves for what they're going to do in life, not do well enough, and hate other people for what they're going to do in life. But every once in a while, one is terrified of death, the fact that he and she is going to die, because they're afraid that if they die, they might roast in hell or something like that for doing wrong deeds. And they foolishly think that they're going to be living after they're dead as ducks. So I show them that that's possible, but it's very little likelihood, and therefore there's no use worrying about it, and the probability of death, dying, is exactly the same state they were in before we were born.
Yeah.
Zero.
Exactly.
Right?
I've always argued that. Now, dead as a duck, well, we're rapidly approaching that time at the end of our lives. Albert, are you concerned about your own demise?
No. I'm not concerned. I'm 88 years of age, and I'm not going to live forever. I also have diabetes, but I'm in fairly good health, and I hope to live to 110 at least. But if I don't, I don't. When I'm not here, I'm not going to worry about not being here. I'm not going to worry about anything.